From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
We establish firmly that Israel has failed to make the necessary distinction between military targets and civilian targets and has killed many, many civilians in its bombing campaign in Lebanon.
Human Rights Watch releases a chilling report. It's called Fatal Strikes, Israel's Indiscriminate Attacks Against Civilians in Lebanon. We'll speak with the emergency director, Peter Buckert, in Beirut. Then could the Lebanese government fall?
I've heard some talk that the Lebanese government might actually resign almost as a way to embarrass the United States even further because this Lebanese government, most of its members, majority, is backed by the U.S.
We'll talk to Newsday's Middle East Bureau Chief in Beirut, Mohammed Bassi. And then we look at media coverage of the conflict from Tel Aviv to Beirut to the United States.
The U.S. media have adopted a timeline to explain the roots of this conflict that effectively gives cover to the Israeli attacks on Lebanon and Gaza and ignores the context that readers and viewers really need.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's resumed airstrikes on the Lebanese capital of Beirut, Lebanon's border with Syria, and the eastern Bekaa Valley. The strikes come one day after Hezbollah fired more than 230 rockets into Israel, the most since fighting began last month. One Israeli man was killed and more than 30 people were wounded. Earlier today in Beirut, Lebanon's Prime Minister Fouad Senyora said the death toll from Israel's invasion has reach 900 people.
It is taking an enormous toll on human life and infrastructure and has totally ravaged our country and shattered our economy. Over 900 killed and 3,000 injured so far, and the number is still rising.
According to Prime Minister Senyora, one-third of the casualties are children under the age of 12. The number of refugees has also reached 1 million people. Senyora's comments come just hours after the Lebanese government warned the attack on Lebanon is inflicting crippling damage on Lebanon's economy and infrastructure. This is the Lebanese Development and Reconstruction official, Fadl al-Shalak.
At the beginning, the damages inflicted by Israel were $2 billion. After 1 week, that increased to $2.5 billion. So within 1 week, the damages inflicted increased by another $500 million. For a country the size of Lebanon, that is a huge loss. This escalation shows the proportion of the catastrophe and the aggression of this war.
Aid workers are warning large numbers of food and supplies are piling up because Israel won't guarantee security for their delivery. On Wednesday, both the UN and Red Cross announced they've delayed aid shipments. The UN World Food Program says it's reached 80,000 people, a tenth of those in need. Meanwhile, Human Rights Watch has released a major report saying Israel's systematically failing to distinguish between combatants and civilians in its attack on Lebanon. Human Rights Watch says some of these attacks constitute war crimes. The report analyzes nearly two dozen strikes that killed 153 civilians, almost half of them children. Human Rights Watch Executive Director Kenneth Roth said, quote, "The pattern of attack shows the Israeli military's disturbing disregard for the lives of Lebanese civilians. In the many cases of civilian deaths examined by Human Rights Watch, the location of Hezbollah troops and arms had nothing to do with the deaths because there was no Hezbollah around." We'll go to Beirut to speak with Peter Buckert of Human Rights Watch after headlines. Meanwhile, Israel says it captured five Hezbollah militants during a raid on the ancient city of Baalbek late Tuesday. Hezbollah says Israel kidnapped civilians, including a 60-year-old grocery store owner and two construction workers. Israel's come under criticism for killing more than 15 civilians, including a family of seven, and shelling the Baalbek hospital. Israel says the hospital was used as a Hezbollah base. The Israeli attack has brought about rare unity between Lebanon's three main religious groups. On Wednesday, Lebanese newspapers published a joint statement released by Lebanon's Maronite Christian Church and Shiite and Sunni Muslim groups. The statement showed photographs of victims of Israeli bombings and praised the Hezbollah-run resistance. The New York Times calls the joint statement an event that would have been unthinkable just a few months ago. Meanwhile, in Vatican City, Pope Benedict repeated his recent calls for an immediate ceasefire.
I nostri occhi sono piene delle agghiaccianti immagini dei corpi straziati di tante persone.
Our eyes are full of the horrifying images of the mangled bodies of so many people, especially children.
Desidero ripetere.
And I am thinking in particular of Cana in Lebanon. I wish to repeat that nothing can justify the spilling of innocent blood for any reason and from any direction that it comes. With a heart full of sorrow, I renew once again a strong appeal to the immediate cessation of all hostilities and all the violence.
In other news, Israel continues its almost daily airstrikes on the Gaza Strip. Earlier today, 7 Palestinians, including at least 2 unarmed civilians, were killed in strikes on southern Gaza. The dead include a 10-year-old boy. Another 25 Palestinians were wounded. The United Nations launched an appeal asking the international community not to forget the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. In a statement signed by 30 aid agencies, the UN says the situation in Gaza is at least as serious as in southern Lebanon. More than 140 Palestinians have been killed since the capture of the Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit in June. The agencies say Israel has slowed the delivery of aid supplies to a trickle. According to the UN, Israel's fired an average of around 150 shells into Gaza each day. Palestinian militants have fired an average of 10 rockets into Israel. In Iraq, more than 50 people were killed in violent attacks Wednesday. In Baghdad, a dozen young Iraqi athletes were killed when their soccer game was bombed. In other Iraq news, a military probe has found evidence that backs allegations U.S. Marines massacred 24 Iraqi civilians in Haditha last November. The Marines initially claimed that 15 civilians died in a roadside blast caused by insurgents. Months later, reports emerged the civilians were killed when Marines burst into their homes and shot them dead in their nightclothes. An ongoing probe is examining whether Marine commanders tried to cover up the events. The news comes as a Marine has filed a defamation suit against Democratic Congressmember John Murtha for saying the killing of civilians in Haditha was deliberate. Meanwhile, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld has reversed his decision not to testify at a Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing on Iraq today. Rumsfeld came under intense criticism after announcing he would not testify publicly and would only meet with senators in a closed briefing. In Mexico, a standoff between activist groups and the governor in the state of Oaxaca is intensifying. On Wednesday, a group of close to 500 women seized a state-run television station. The women banged spoons against pots and pans and broadcast footage showing police beating protesters at a major rally last month. The action was the latest in the continuing struggle against the Oaxaca governor, Ulises Ruiz. He's been accused of fixing his election victory 2 years ago and violently suppressing opposition groups. In Las Vegas, the American Civil Liberties Union has filed suit to strike down a new law that makes it illegal to feed the homeless in public parks. The Las Vegas City Council approved the measure last month. Violators will face a fine of up to $1,000 and as many as 6 months in prison. 3 people have already been arrested for the offense. City officials say they've enacted the law because soup kitchens have kept people away from visiting public spaces. The lawsuit was filed on behalf of the group Food Not Bombs, which provides free vegetarian meals to the poor. In Seattle, Washington, the man accused in last week's shooting at the Jewish Federation office was charged Wednesday with 9 felony counts, including murder and committing a hate crime. One woman was killed and 5 people were wounded in the attack. Navid Afzal Haq reportedly told the victims he was mad at Israel and the war in Iraq. And in San Francisco, an independent video journalist has been jailed for refusing to turn over footage of a protest subpoenaed by a grand jury. Josh Wolf could remain in jail until he hands over the tape or until the investigation is concluded. Prosecutors maintain Wolf's footage shows demonstrators setting a fire a police vehicle. Wolf says no such images exist, but will not hand over the tape in accordance with his First Amendment rights. Those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Human Rights Watch has accused Israel of committing war crimes in Lebanon for systematically failing to distinguish between combatants and civilians in their attack on Lebanon. Last night, the group issued a major report. It's called Fatal Strikes, Israel's Indiscriminate Attacks Against Civilians in Lebanon. The co-author of the report, Peter Bookert, joins us on the phone from Beirut. He's the Emergencies Director for Human Rights Watch. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Peter.
Thanks for having me on.
Can you tell us what you found?
Human Rights Watch has been on the ground in Lebanon, as well as in Israel, investigating the kind of attacks that are taking place on both sides of this border. Our findings have been that Israel is carrying out indiscriminate attacks inside Lebanon, and that this is resulting in the death of many civilians. We've identified eyewitnesses and survivors to many of these attacks, and we can clearly state that Israel's excuse that Hezbollah is really responsible for the civilian deaths has no foundation in fact, because in many of these strikes where civilians are being killed, like the tragic case in Kana just a few days ago, there was no Hezbollah anywhere nearby and no rocket firing taking place when Israel struck civilian homes and civilian cars.
Can you talk more about what you found in Kana? Are you revising the numbers downward of the number of people killed there?
Yes. There originally, it was reported that more than 50 people died in Kana. However, our preliminary investigation, based on interviews with the survivors and the doctors at the hospital and rescue workers, has now established that at least 28 people died in Kana. Those bodies have been recovered. It's possible that the death toll will rise slightly, but we do not think that it will rise to the 54 people who had been originally reported killed. There was no conscious effort by the Lebanese authorities to inflate the death toll from Kana. It simply happened in the chaos and confusion of the rescue effort that certain assumptions were made, because the authorities had a list of 63 people who were believed to be inside the building, and they had identified only 9 survivors. However, they reached the village only hours after the attack had taken place, and in fact, there were at least 22 survivors. So that explains the discrepancy which happened in the heat of the moment in this very difficult rescue effort.
Is it possible there are still bodies in the wreckage?
Well, according to the family members, at least 13 people are still missing from the home they were sheltering in Kana. It's unclear whether their bodies remain buried or whether they fled from the scene during the bombardment in the night and simply have not been located. The rescue effort and the recovery effort has now been called off in Kana. The recovery teams do not expect to find any more bodies. So we're still trying to establish what has happened to these 13 people. But I think it's important that this slight controversy over the numbers of those killed in Kana does not distract from the fact that a very brutal attack took place in Kana, a totally unjustified attack took place, and that Israel has had to backtrack significantly on its original statement. Originally, Israel said that they had attacked Kana because Hezbollah was there and was firing rockets at the time of the attack. Now, Israeli officials have been forced to admit, under heavy scrutiny, that they had no information about Hezbollah presence at the time of the attack or rocket firing, and that Kana had simply been put on the target list because several days before rockets had been fired from nearby Kana. And that just shows you how indiscriminate many of these attacks are. Israel is not adhering to the laws of war because it's failing to distinguish between military objects it's entitled to attack and civilian homes, cars, and infrastructure, which it should refrain from attacking. And that's why so many civilians are dying in Lebanon today.
Peter Bookert is Emergencies Director of Human Rights Watch. Looking at the Lebanese government and Lebanese Red Cross's response to the Human Rights Watch report, and they stand by 57 deaths in Kana. They say it's confirmed there are 57 bodies, according to Elias Diab, an official in the Lebanese Red Cross operations room in Beirut. 27 of them are children, he said.
Well, we went to visit a hospital in Tire, which is the official government hospital where all the bodies were taken to. We established that there are 28 bodies there, and according to the officials at the hospitals, there are no bodies which were taken to any other hospitals. We're certainly willing to look at the evidence that the Lebanese authorities have and revise our death figures. But I spoke to many journalists who were on the scene of this very brutal killing all day long, who closely followed the recovery effort, and they reported to me that they did not see more than 27, 28 bodies being recovered from the rubble. But as I said before, I think it's really important that this controversy over the numbers does not distract from the larger picture of what is happening in Lebanon today. We issued a report today called Fatal Strikes, Israel's Indiscriminate Attacks Against Civilians in Lebanon, which is on our website, www.hrw.org, which clearly shows that Israel time and time again is striking civilian homes and civilian cars, killing entire families without any military object in sight. And there is a deep, deep crisis in southern Lebanon today. Tens of thousands of civilians remain stuck in their homes in towns which are the scenes of very fierce fighting, and they're simply not able to flee because the fighting is too fierce and because their cars are being attacked on the road and because they cannot afford the extremely high taxi fares that are being charged. At the same time, Israeli officials are saying that anybody left in the south after they've issued these warnings is going to be considered a Hezbollah supporter and therefore a fair legitimate target. It's a dire situation. Humanitarian supplies are running out. Medical personnel cannot reach the wounded. Bodies are being left in the street rotting because recovery teams cannot reach them. And that should be the focus of our attention. And there needs to be real pressure on the international community and on Israel and Hezbollah to allow for an improvement in the humanitarian situation and to respect the laws of war.
Peter Booker, what are those laws? Human Rights Watch accusing Israel of war crimes. What exactly are war crimes?
Well, war crimes are grave breaches of the laws of war. And the laws of war have a very clear principle. Combatants like Israel and Hezbollah have to distinguish between military targets that they are allowed to attack and civilian objects which they have to refrain from attacking. Obviously, sometimes civilians do get killed in legitimate military attacks. I've worked in Kosovo, Afghanistan, and Iraq, and we documented many abuses there too, and many cases in which civilians were killed. But what we see in Lebanon is very different, and also what we see in Israel. Inside Israel, Hezbollah is carrying out direct attacks against civilians with the aim to kill civilians, and this is a war crime because there are attacks against civilians. Inside Lebanon, we find that Israel is not making the most fundamental distinction of the laws of war, which is that it has to refrain from attacking civilian objects. In plain words, before pulling the trigger, they have to make sure that they're aiming at a military target. And time again, we find that civilians are being killed without any military objective in sight.
Peter Bookert, the head of the military, Chalutz, the general, says that Hezbollah places civilians as a defensive shield between itself and us, while the army places itself as a defensive shield between the citizens of Israel and Hezbollah's terror. That's the main difference between us, he says, Hezbollah using civilians as a human shield. Your response?
Well, Human Rights Watch has no problem denouncing the kind of war crimes and abuses that Hezbollah is committing against Israel. We have said since the beginning that these are war crimes and that Hezbollah should stop these indiscriminate attacks against civilians. But at the same time, it's a very convenient excuse for Israel to say that civilians are being killed because Hezbollah is shielding behind them. And that's simply not the reality on the ground in many of the cases we have documented. Time and time again, we have documented that civilians have been killed without any Hezbollah being in the neighborhood, without any Hezbollah being inside their homes, and without any Hezbollah weapons being stored. And also that civilians are being hit on the road time and time again when they're traveling in cars which are clearly marked with white flags. On a daily basis, Israel is hitting ambulances, they're hitting humanitarian convoys, they're hitting UN bases multiple times a day, sometimes 30 separate attacks on UN observer posts are being documented in a single day. So the problem is that Israel simply is not taking the kind of precautions they need to take. Yes, Hezbollah is a difficult enemy to fight. It's a guerrilla enemy. It's not an enemy with tanks and armored cars, which are easy to hit. But Israel has an obligation to take the precautions required under the laws of war. And I've been in Iraq and Afghanistan and Kosovo and Chechnya and many other places, and I've seen these distinctions being made by armies. And so what we are seeing in Lebanon is very different from what we see in these other conflicts.
Peter Bookert, Human Rights Watch, has also reported on cluster bombs, the Israeli military use of that. Can you elaborate?
Yes. My research team in northern Israel has been able to photograph cluster bombs in the possession of the artillery teams firing into Lebanon. And we have also been able to document their use on the ground inside Lebanon. Cluster bombs are very dangerous weapons. Basically, what happens is that an artillery shell is fired, it opens up over its target and drops these small bomblets over a very wide area, which are supposed to explode on impact. They create a virtual minefield, exploding minefield when they drop. Now, what we find is that it's an indiscriminate weapon which is extremely dangerous to use against a civilian populated area. And we documented in the village of Blida a cluster bomb attack which killed an elderly woman and wounded an entire family of 12, including 7 children. The husband of that family lost both of his legs in the attack. But the problem also with cluster bombs, in addition to them being an indiscriminate weapon, is that many of them fail to explode. As much as 14% of cluster bombs, bomblets, so small bomblets, fail to explode. And so they leave behind a legacy of death and destruction and maiming after this conflict is over. And it's not just a theoretical legacy. In Kosovo and Iraq, we found that children pick these things up because they're curious. Farmers step on them when they're out working their fields. Israel absolutely should not be using cluster bombs in this conflict. And it's an entirely inappropriate weapon against the guerrilla force anyway from a military perspective, because cluster bombs are designed to be used against dense concentrations of military troops. You drop cluster bombs on them to kill them. They're an anti-personnel weapon. They should not be used against a widely dispersed enemy like Hezbollah, which isn't concentrated in any place.
Peter Bookert, after Human Rights Watch came out with its report on Israel's use of cluster bombs, they admitted, in fact, they are using cluster bombs, but they said they're using them legally. What does that mean?
Well, they also issued one of the most bizarre statements I've ever heard of. One Israeli official said they're using cluster bombs, yes, but they're not using them against populated areas, and they're also not using them against Hezbollah. So I'm not quite sure what he was trying to say they're using them against. We don't think cluster bombs can be used within laws of war in populated areas. It's simply too dangerous a weapon. It's too indiscriminate a weapon. And all countries should refrain from using cluster bombs in populated areas. And we're talking about our experience in Kosovo, Iraq, and Afghanistan, where we documented horrendous death tolls and horrendous injuries because cluster bombs were used in urban areas, especially by the U.S. and U.K. government in Iraq, where they used them widely in populated areas.
Are there any reports of the use of phosphorus as a weapon?
There are many reports of the use of phosphorus, and we know that the Israelis have phosphorus in their military, along with their artillery team. Now, the issue with phosphorus is different because there are legitimate uses of phosphorus as a weapon, not as a weapon, as an illumination tool. But the problem occurs when phosphorus is used as an offensive weapon because it causes horrific burn wounds, which can be very disfiguring to civilians. There have been reports that Israel has fired on vehicles and at homes with phosphorus weapons. We're still investigating those. And we do take them serious because in Fallujah, the U.S. Marines did use phosphorus as an offensive weapon after first denying they did. And it was a very serious violation of the laws of war.
Peter Bookert, I wanted to ask you about another weapon, the reports of the U.S. sending Israel bunker buster bombs, GBU-28, guided bomb unit bombs, and that they're depleted uranium. Do you know about this?
Yes, we have seen those reports, and those shipments are already going through to Israel. There's a controversy between the United States and England about the use of English bases to transfer weapons to Israel without seeking permission from English authorities. And we think it's very disturbing that at this moment the U.S. is still sending weapons to Israel when there is such widespread evidence of their misuse by the Israeli authorities. Yes, these are smart munitions, and in an ideal world, it's good to use smart munitions because you end up hitting the targets you want to hit. But the evidence on the ground clearly establishes that Israel is misusing these weapons, that they're firing them indiscriminately at civilian targets. So we believe it's important that countries put some limits on the way their weapons are used and stop weapon shipments if weapons are used in violation of the Geneva Convention.
Peter Bookert, we want to thank you very much for being with us, Emergencies Director at Human Rights Watch. He's speaking to us from Beirut. The report that Human Rights Watch has just put out is called Fatal Strikes, Israel's Indiscriminate Attacks Against Civilians in Lebanon. And we'll also link to it at our website at democracynow.org. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Samir Gibran here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue our coverage of the situation in the Middle East by examining how the U.S. press has been reporting on Lebanon, Israel, and Gaza. Some have suggested that America is watching a different war than much of the world. The British journalist Julian Borger came to that conclusion after watching the news in Washington and London. The British press, he said, overwhelmingly emphasizes civilian casualties in Lebanon, but that the U.S. media has focused on the situation in Israel and cities like Haifa. Meanwhile, some journalists from the Middle East are now refusing to work with American news outlets. Earlier this week, two producers working for Fox News in Amman, Jordan, resigned in protest. In their resignation letter, Serene Sabah and Jomana Karadzic wrote, quote, "We can no longer work with a news organization that claims to be fair and balanced when you're so far from that." They went on to write, quote, "Not only are you an instrument of the Bush White House and Israeli propaganda, you are warmongers with no sense of decency nor professionalism." Well, in a few minutes, we're going to speak with a panel of media analysts and journalists here in New York, in Beirut, and in Tel Aviv. But first, an excerpt from the documentary Peace Propaganda and the Promised Land, U.S. Media and the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. The film was directed by Bathsheba Ratzkoff and Sujali of the Media Education Foundation.
CBS Evening News.
Americans rely on the news media for information about events occurring around the world. News, especially television news, exerts a powerful influence on our perceptions, telling us which events are important and shaping our understanding of the issues. Given the central role played by the United States in the Middle East conflict, and thus the vital role played by American voters, influencing U.S. media coverage of the conflict is crucial. Controlling the images and words used to explain the conflict has become an important extension of the struggle.
Israel is really fighting a war on two fronts. The first is a military campaign being waged in the occupied territories against the Palestinian people. And the second is a PR campaign being waged here in the U.S. through the American media to ensure continued support for Israel's occupation. Alon Pincus, Consul General for Israel in New York and the coordinator of Israel's PR efforts, was recently quoted as saying, "We are currently in a conflict with the Palestinians, and engaging in a successful PR campaign is part of winning the conflict." So you could say that in addition to the military occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, Israel is also involved in an attempt to ideologically occupy the American media.
The roots of Israel's public relations campaign go back to the 1982 Israeli invasion of Lebanon that earned it worldwide criticism. In particular, the massacre of Palestinian civilians at the refugee camps of Sabra and Shatila. To the Israeli government, the problem was not the deaths of thousands of civilians. Rather, it was the damage to Israel's public image, a public relations disaster in need of damage control.
They surrounded Beirut. In 3 months, 17,500 people, almost all of them civilians, were killed. I saw many thousands of their bodies. Then came the massacre of Sabra and Shatila by Israel's own allies as the camp was surrounded by Israeli troops. And they desperately said, what went wrong? It was concluded that the problem was there wasn't good enough public relations.
After the public relations disaster of Lebanon, Israel decided to set up permanent institutional structures to control how Americans would think about the Middle East. In 1983, Israel launched the Hasbara project, the aim of which was to ensure good press in the U.S. media. The goal was to train Israeli diplomats in communications and public relations. For example, they trained press officers in Israeli consulates in the U.S. to ensure that American journalists would write stories favorable to Israel. As one of these press officers said in the 1980s, he had breakfast, lunch, and dinner with journalists, and that a typical day would involve conversations with producers at leading news and TV talk shows about the content of the program. He described it as, in fact, quote, a joint formulation of ideas. This targeting of the American media goes on in the present day.
The Israeli press office is spitting out press releases, statements, information all the time. So you could sit in a bureau in Jerusalem and file stories from there all the time without really having to have much imagination or have much energy or have much drive. The Palestine Authority press office is almost useless, and they certainly aren't providing you with ready-made stories the way the Israeli press office is.
Because of lack of access to Palestinian officials in the West Bank and the sophistication of Israel's PR techniques inside Israel, a lot of times the stories are already tilted in Israel's favor before they ever leave American journalists sitting in the area.
When you're talking about how the story is covered from the U.S., the propaganda machine is even more effective than it is in Israel.
American news coverage is influenced by a complex set of institutional relationships. These influences can be thought of as a series of filters through which the news must travel before it emerges in the voices of news anchors. To understand how American news media report on the Middle East conflict, we need to understand how these institutional filters operate. Among the most important of these filters are the business interests of the corporations that own the mass media, interests that extend beyond the United States and across the globe to the Middle East. The economic interests of media owners are shared by political elites, politicians and policymakers who form a second filter. These political elites have the power to access and influence mainstream media and are themselves part of a system dominated by corporate money and interests. The strategic importance of the Middle East to these two groups is reflected in media coverage of the region and of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. A third filter, Israel's own public relations efforts, further affects the coverage. The government of Israel employs some of the largest American public relations firms as image consultants to coordinate its political and media campaigns. Nine Israeli consulates help implement these PR campaigns by developing relationships with journalists and monitoring media outlets. Scores of private American organizations, both Christian and Jewish, reiterate the official line and organize grassroots opposition to any coverage deemed unfavorable to Israel. The most important of these is AIPAC, the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, widely regarded as the most powerful foreign lobby in Washington. This institutional framework of American business and political interests in combination with Israeli public relations shapes media coverage of the Middle East. At the same time, those progressive organizations opposing Israeli government policy, such as Jews Against the Occupation and Americans for Peace Now, rarely make it through these filters. Finally, if any news stories critical of Israeli policy do surface, there are a host of media watchdog groups that monitor and pressure journalists and media outlets, the most important of which is CAMRA.
You have activist organizations from the right, the pro-Israeli right, that very effectively, they say monitor, I would say harass, journalists and their editors and try to make sure that the coverage is objective, by which they mean pro-Israel.
You can see all of the, you know, kind of pressure groups who, you know, write campaigns of letters to the editor against, you know, news outlets and ask for, you know, demand that stories be changed or that, you know, that reporters be fired.
The abuse against a journalist is something you just have to take into account. If you, you know, both literally and metaphorically, if you work in the Middle East, you've got to take the sticks and stones. What I object to is that my American colleagues don't seem to be prepared to do that.
And even in Israel itself, you know, you can find the main daily newspapers, like Haaretz, for example, provides coverage on the ground and analysis, some of which has views on the conflict that you would never, that would be almost beyond the pale for an American journalist, say, at the New York Times to write.
The main major television news networks and newspapers in the United States have long ago got their fear to be supreme over their duties as journalists. They are not monitoring the centers of power when it comes to the relationship between America and the Middle East, Israel and America, and America and the Arabs and the Palestinians. They will not ask the right questions, they will not report it using the correct words, they will not confront the reality, and they've given up. And I think once you acquire fear, it's very difficult to get rid of it.
Robert Fisk, war correspondent of The Independent. In the documentary Peace, Propaganda, and the Promised Land, U.S. Media and the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict, produced by the Media Education Foundation. You can go to their website at pppl.org. We'll link to it at democracynow.org. As we talk about media coverage, we're joined by Peter Hart in our New York studio of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, Habib Batah in Lebanon, and Gideon Levy of Haaretz in Israel. We welcome you all to Democracy Now. Peter Hart, let's begin with you. Your assessment of the current crisis coverage.
I think there are a lot of things to talk about. One of the first things to understand is that the media in this country are obsessed with a timeline, establishing when history began in this story. And usually in the media, it begins when Palestinians attack. CBS reporter Bob Simon said just as much a couple of weeks ago on the evening news. June 25th, Hamas captures an Israeli soldier. That's when history began. July 12th, Hezbollah does the same, captures two Israeli soldiers. That's when the story begins. You can appreciate this history, but you have to ignore a lot of very relevant history. Dozens of Palestinians dead in Gaza in the months prior. The attempt to destroy the Palestinian government in Gaza. The fact that the day before this capture of an Israeli soldier in the West Bank, two Hamas members, alleged Hamas members, were captured by Israeli forces in Gaza, crossing that border. We hear a lot of talk about borders and sovereignty being the story, but when Israel crosses that border, it's apparently not a story. The same is true in Lebanon. There's a lot of context to that story that predates July 12th. In late May, a member of Islamic Jihad was killed in Lebanon. Many people in Lebanon and Israel actually think Israel had something to do with it. Border skirmishes have been going on for the past month and a half or so. These are things that are excluded from the timeline. If you read your newspaper, they have a graph, they have a chart. Almost all of them have done this. And they begin on June 25th, they begin on July 12th, and they ignore all of this relevant backstory.
You were mentioning Bob Simon, you mean Bob Schieffer of CBS.
Bob Simon did that. Bob Schieffer pretends that the timeline doesn't matter. He says, this is the Middle East, it doesn't matter who did what. These are irrational people, which is at best lazy, and I think at worst, downright bigoted.
Gideon Levy, you work for Haaretz in Israel. What is the Israeli press reporting?
You mean the coverage of the war right now?
Yes.
You see, always in times of war, the rules are changing a little bit. And what happens to the entire society happens also to the media, namely becoming more united, more nationalistic, more militaristic, and even more chauvinistic and violent. Same happens here, though I must tell you there is a sense of criticism already now about this war, but mainly about tactical aspects of it. Should we use the territorial option or not? Did the army function well or not? Questions like this are being raised already now. My main criticism about the Israeli media right now is a very old one, namely ignoring almost totally the sacrifice of the other, the sacrifice of the Lebanese people, the destruction, the killings. All this is covered in the Israeli media in a very, very hidden way, modest way, and really out of proportion, so that the Israeli reader is not really exposed to pictures and reports that a European reader is exposed to. This, I think, is not something to be proud about.
I'm going to ask you after break about how this relates to public opinion in Israel, the whole issue of media manufacturing consent for war. We'll also be joined by Habib Hada in Lebanon, who has been watching U.S. media from Beirut. Stay with us.
Jack.
Luc Vibrant here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. The War and Peace Report, we're broadcasting on over 450 radio and television stations around the country on Pacifica Radio and NPR, low-power FM college and community radio stations, public access TV and PBS stations, and on both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and also on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. And our headlines are in Spanish and both audio and transcript form at our website, democracynow.org, as we talk about media coverage from Tel Aviv, from Beirut, and from here in the United States. We're joined by Peter Hart of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. We're joined by Gideon Levy in Tel Aviv of the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. And in Beirut, we're joined by Habib Batah. He is managing editor of Middle East Broadcasters Journal, a former correspondent for the Beirut Daily Star and Al Jazeera. He recently published a piece in Al Jazeera called Watching American TV in Beirut. Well, Habib Batah, what do you see?
When I'm watching the media coverage here from Lebanon, I'm reminded of the American media coverage. I'm reminded of being in Qatar during the Iraq War, at the beginning of it at least, and watching how the use of sources on American media reflected the policy of the United States government. And those sources are mainly retired military analysts. I was watching a show last night, Hardball on MSNBC, and the three guests were two American generals and a former colonel. So there really isn't a diversity of opinion. These sources allow assumptions to be made that kind of slip under the radar, and these assumptions typically would assume the best of Israel and the worst of Hezbollah. So the conflict isn't approached from an objective point of view. It's approached from a reflection of the policy of the government. Just like the United States government won't talk to Hezbollah, American media, you'll rarely find a Hezbollah source being featured or Hezbollah claims being countered to IDF claims. Just like in the Iraq War, the IDF claims become the main source of information, the sole source often, which misleads that into being the fact on the ground. We hear the American reporters assume that Hezbollah is using human shields. At the same time, they also assume that Israel has committed all of these massive killings of civilians by accident, and that the killing of the UN soldiers was, as some reporters put it, even before the Israeli government came out and apologized for this, reporters on some British networks and American networks were saying this was an accident waiting to happen. So that's an assumption, whereas on the Hezbollah side, the assumption would be absolute worst that these are using human shields. And I just wanted to also mention the tone of the coverage, the reporters' familiarity with Israel and Israeli cities compared to Lebanon. And we see, for example, some reporters describing Tel Aviv as a city that is very, very familiar. It's like a city in California, they said, a very modern city. When an attack is on Nazareth, they'll call it the holy town of Nazareth, the hometown of Jesus. When there was an attack on Cana, we didn't hear that, you know, Cana has a biblical reference as well as being the place where Jesus made wine. There was no identity identifying with that place. Beirut as well could be described as the city in California in some sense. So that's a real problem in identifying and actually giving more sympathy.
Habib Atah speaking to us from Beirut, managing editor of Middle East Broadcasters. Gideon Levy with us from Tel Aviv with Haaretz. Gideon, what about this issue of how the Israeli media coverage relates to Israeli public opinion? And I'm wondering if today in your headlines, if the headlines in newspapers in Israel report on this Human Rights Watch report that says that Israel is deliberately targeting civilians.
I didn't see it. I mean, I think I saw it in one of the websites, but I didn't see it in the newspapers. But I can assure you if it will appear, in a very small place. As all the question of human rights and all the question of the damages that we created in Lebanon is partly hidden from the Israeli public opinion, hidden in a way that it does not get the proportional place. not in size, not in the location. As you know, location is very important in media. So if you mention in the end of a news program 20 casualties, it's one thing, and if you say just in the beginning, it's another thing. The scenes that we see from Lebanon, we see pictures from Lebanon. It's not that we don't see pictures of Lebanon. But if someone wants really to know how does it look like there, he has to move to BBC or CNN or Sky News or one of those international networks. Because in Israel, they will show again and again our casualties, our sacrifice, which is very natural and very understandable. The only problem is lack of proportion.
And how does it relate to Israeli public opinion? Do you think Israeli public opinion would change if the media changed?
That's a big question that I kept on asking myself for many years concerning the occupation. Would the Israelis know everything about the brutality and the cruelty of the occupation? Would they change their minds? It's a speculation. I truly believe that for sure, at least among part of the Israelis, it might have brought to a change in their perceptions, because would they really know how cruel the occupation is? I think they couldn't live in peace with it. And they would have understand that a democracy, a civilized society, cannot live with such phenomena in its backyard. But, you know, it's just a speculation, because the matter of fact is that most of the Israelis are not exposed. One more remark, you might also say that the Israelis who want to know, they can quite easily know, because if you are really interested, you have the place where to look at, both in the Israeli media and in foreign media. The problem is that most of them also don't want to know. That's the problem.
I just wanted to be specific about what I said. The Human Rights Watch report says Israel is indiscriminately targeting civilians. I said deliberately. They said indiscriminately. Habib Attah, you've been comparing the same network, that is CNN, with CNN International. Is that right? Can you see what we see here in the United States, which is different than CNN International?
Yeah, it's very interesting that there is a very big difference in the reporting styles of CNN International and CNN United States. Reporters on the American network will recently, a reporter with the IDF said that Hezbollah is like no terror organization Israel has ever seen. Whereas the international reporters won't describe Hezbollah as a terrorist organization. They'll call it a militia. So you kind of wonder, why would they adjust the message based on the audience when the goal is journalism? It shouldn't really change from audience to audience. And in that way, again, we are seeing a reflection of the American policy of labeling Hezbollah as a terrorist organization.
Peter Hart of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, the images that we see in the United States.
I think it goes without saying that Americans see a very different war in this case. And in most cases, you're mentioning the Human Rights Watch report. It's reported halfway through a page one story in the New York Times today. The headline in the New York Times is, "Civilians lose as fighters slip into fog of war." The subhead is, "Lebanese deaths show dilemma for Israel." That is the approach, I think, of a lot of television reporters, that there is a PR battle that Israel is losing if we show the realities of this war. There's a CNN show called Reliable Sources, the media discussion show hosted by Howard Kurtz, the Washington Post reporter. It has been obsessed with the idea that television might be too graphic in the United States, that people will get the wrong impression being that Lebanese civilians are the ones who are suffering under this bombardment from the Israeli military. That is underscored by CNN reporters, Anderson Cooper, Paula Zahn, Wolf Blitzer, constantly reminding viewers after a particularly gruesome or graphic report that Hezbollah hides among civilians, so this is the trouble you get into when you do this. It's reminiscent after 9/11 and when the war in Afghanistan began, there was a memo inside CNN. if you're showing graphic images of Afghanistan, remind viewers that this is happening because of 9/11. CNN would cut back to ground zero to remind people that however you feel about those images, if you feel that these people are suffering for no reason, you should be reminded that they're getting something that they deserve. And I think that's the message that CNN and much of the rest of the media is sending right now.
It's interesting. I was invited on MSNBC and Chris Matthews Show Hardball for the 10th anniversary of MSNBC, and they were doing it live from Rockefeller Plaza. He usually does it in Washington, D.C., and there was a crowd of bystanders. And when we were in commercial, the producers said to people, if they're going to be on camera, they were handing out American flags. So on the one hand, they said these are just New Yorkers, and if you wanted to be called on, you know, you'd wave that American flag, whatever your view was. But it certainly skewed the image that people had of who these New Yorkers were.
And I think there really is no debate in the media about the current war. There is no debate in Washington. I think the media reflects that. I think the only real dissenter who's regularly on the American media is Pat Buchanan. And that really says something about the spectrum of debate. Public opinion polls suggest that there's a good chunk of the American public who thinks this has gone too far. The Israeli response has gone too far. That idea is mentioned almost nowhere in the American media.
I wanted to go back to Gideon Levy, Israeli journalist with Haaretz. Your piece, Operation Peace for the IDF, the war that the IDF has declared on Lebanon and Gaza will never be considered another war of no choice. This is unequivocally a war of choice, you write. Why?
I think there is no doubt about it. There was a provocation made by the Hezbollah, and Israel has chosen to react in a very, very, very aggressive way, attacking almost all Lebanon. And this is a war of choice. Justified or not, it was a choice of Israel to react. It could have reacted in a much more limited way, local way, just attacking the Hezbollah bases around the border. But Israel chose to go to an overall war against Hezbollah, which is almost an overall war against Lebanon. This is a classical war of choice.
Can I just add, it's not
Habib
almost
Bata
a war
in
Lebanon.
Beirut.
Yeah, it's not almost a war. Being here in Beirut, you just have to go down to the gas station and find that there's no gasoline, or go to the hospital and find out that in a matter of days, life support systems will probably end because there's no more electricity in the country. So it's not really a war against Hezbollah, and it's very disheartening to watch the reporters report from a major bridge and say this is a Hezbollah supply line, when actually, you know, for all we know, Hezbollah is probably out in the bushes or on some, you know, four-wheel drive. This is a major civilian bridge that hundreds of thousands of people were using. Another big problem that I also see, and I would build on the point about the CNN memo, is I was watching CNN last night, and they were reading a viewer opinion. And it was an opinion of a New York City fireman. And the anchor introduced it by saying it was a very emotional letter. And the fireman was saying from New York City that you only have to stand on 9/11, the ruins of 9/11, to understand all of this death and killing in the world today. And so we wonder, you know, what does Lebanon have to do, this conflict between territory and soldiers and prisoners, have to do with the events of September 11th? Nothing, really.
I wanted to ask you, Habib Bata, about the bombing of Al-Manar, the communications tower, at the beginning of the attack, the TV
sure,
station.
Sure. Al-Manar, I mean, if you're not familiar, it's actually a network that is very strongly supportive of Hezbollah. It wasn't the only channel that was targeted by Israel, though. I mean, Israel also targeted the communication towers for several Lebanese stations, including LBC, which is a Christian broadcaster and the most vocally critical of Hezbollah, the only network that seems to be actually criticizing Hezbollah at this point. It's very strange to understand their strategy of why they would be knocking that out. The view was that basically the images being shown on international television were very strong. And I was, you know, the follow-up of reporters is also important, and I haven't seen that follow-up. I haven't seen a lot of reporters asking Israeli officials just why they bombed the towers that were used by LBC
Habib Bata, we're going to have to leave it there. Managing editor of Middle East Broadcasters, also Peter Hart of Fairness and Accuracy Reporting, and finally Gideon Levy of Haaretz newspaper speaking to us from Tel Aviv. And that does it for today's broadcast. Mohammed Bazzi will join us tomorrow on Democracy Now, along with Juan Cole. So tune in on Friday. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks to Mike Berkshire, Fabio Caduce, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Rich, and Aaron Mate, Frank Lopez, Mike DiFilippo, Nick Marsilio, our engineer. Special thanks to Danielle Strandberg-Peshkin. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.